Faith in its proper perspective is really asking a different set of questions.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger!
Don't let the system subvert you to their will.
Do not be conformed any longer to the pattern
danger.
Of this world.
Nero, in particular, is violently oppressive of Christians. He set them afire.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Now, tonight, what we wanted to talk about, the things that they don't tell you. Do you ever have the impression that there was something that someone is not telling you? You ever have the impression that there's something out there, you feel it's true, you feel it's a real thing, but someone's not telling me. There's something that someone's not telling me. I remember being 10 years old, and I was my parents were getting together with some friends. I was a young, newly married couple. They were having a meal with them. I remember going out, and we were in a restaurant. I'm 10 years old, and they're doing adult talking, and they're kind of ignoring me and forgetting that I'm there. And at one point, you knew that they were ignoring me because the newly married couple, the woman talked about going on the pill. And I heard this, and I said, "What pill? What's the pill?" Because there was a kind of a frisson in the air, and I knew something different and new and wonderful had just been spoken about. And so I said, "What's the pill?" My mum, she's very honest. You know, she's always trying to be real and truthful with me. And she said, "Well, Philip, it's a birth control pill." And I said, "What's a birth control pill?" My dad now takes over. He says, "Son, it's about time you knew where babies come from." He says, "The birth control pill is this. When a man and woman get married and love each other very much, if they want to have a baby, then the woman goes to the doctor and the doctor gives her a pill and she eats this pill and then they have a baby. It's a birth control pill. And that's where babies come from. They come from having eaten the pill." And everybody laughed. They all laughed. And I kind of felt like, yeah, you're saying this, but everyone's laughing. I feel there's something you're not telling me. I feel like I've not really heard the full truth. Now, I naturally believe that it just happens, no particular reason. It's just a natural process of life. We don't really need to know anymore. But this pill thing has got me worried. I feel like you're not telling me something, and there's something that you know and I don't know. And if you've ever been in that position, you know that you need someone who will explain things to you. You need someone that's going to come alongside and say, "Right, this is what they're not telling you." It's really important. And so I was kind of, you know, I just couldn't get this thing out of my brain. And so I went to the kid in the playground, you know, junior school playground. There's always one kid who's like an early developer. You know, they're like 6 foot tall. They've got a mustache. And so I go to this kid and I said, "Do you know, my parents, they say that babies come because you eat a pill and then it produces a baby." They all laughed. I think they're not telling me something. And this kid said, "Yeah, you know, my brother's told me all about this." This is before we had the internet. You know, kids didn't learn from hardcore pornography on the internet. Back in those days, you learned on the playground or from your kind of older brother. And he said, "Yeah, my older brother." And he told me this stuff. And I'm like, "Really? Stuff comes out of your thing?" And he said, "No, no, it's true." I said, "I don't believe that. That sounds ridiculous." He says, "What is it like?" He says, "Well, I'm not quite sure, but I have spoken to my brother. And from what I can gather from my brother, I think it's a bit like squirty cream." I says, "What do you mean?" "You know, squirty cream, when you sort of shake it up and then you squirt it and then it comes, it's like whipped and foamy and it comes out in like a star shape." He says, "Yeah, I think that's about it." So he didn't have all the exact precise details, but he did basically explain to me, kind of roughly, what I needed to know. The things that people won't tell you, you need an explainer. Now, what I'm going to do in this message, just recover yourselves. We're through the worst of it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you three things that people don't usually tell you. Three things that people don't usually tell you about faith. And if that sounds like a bad BuzzFeed listicle, then it probably is, because number three will amaze you. But we're going to go through those. But first of all, I just need to give a little bit of context. Because sometimes if people come to Metro, they can kind of get a bit of a weird impression. They think, you know, we like it. Metro's cool. The worship's amazing. Everyone's super friendly. Donuts. But when you preach and when you do the talks, it's not like in our church at home. Because in our church at home, you know, we open the Bible and we read the Bible and then we talk about that. And you're giving me three things that people don't usually tell you. Well, listen, just to put your mind at rest, next week when we come back for the final part of this series, we're going to do a deep dive into Jesus' first public message. And then we've got a whole series examining the parables of Jesus. So we are legit. We're a proper church. We do actually read the Bible and study it. But there is a precedent for talking sometimes, every now and again, in a way that takes a little step back and looks at the world just in the most common denominator way possible. And actually, one of the most famous preachers, the most famous sermons, the most famous talks that was ever delivered in the Bible was delivered by Paul, one of the early believers. And Paul gave this message. It was the first time that anybody had preached the Christian message to people that weren't Jews. It's a whole big deal. And just to give you a little bit of background, now 2 weeks ago, when we did Roman Candles, if you haven't seen that, go back, watch it online, really worth it. But we talked about the way that the early church spread. So when people say, oh, it's, you know, it's all just myth and it took hundreds of years to arrive and for people to exaggerate and things get out of hand, that just doesn't hold water when you look at the truth, the history. The early church spread in such great numbers that within 30 years of the crucifixion of Christ, there was thousands of Christians 3,000 miles away, 2,000 miles away in Rome. So this was like a big, big deal. It's an expansion of the church. And Paul was one of the original Jewish religious leaders that persecuted the church and then encountered the risen Jesus and then began to proclaim the good news that Jesus was risen from the dead, that God is real and that he's done something brand new in humanity. Now, about 15 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, Paul, with a team, goes on this journey. And they go on a journey spreading the Christian message all around the Mediterranean rim. So they're in Syria, they're in Turkey, they're going always to Jewish synagogues, speaking in the synagogues to Jews, saying, the Jewish Messiah, Jesus, is real, he's come, and this is his message. He's proved it by rising from the dead. And so they plant little churches, little house churches, all across the Mediterranean rim. Now, 2 years after he's had that first journey, a few of his friends, they say, let's go back, let's encourage the Christians there. And so they do the same thing. And then it suddenly gets hijacked, because one night Paul, and you can read about this in the book of Acts, it's an amazing read, Paul has a dream, and in his dream, someone from northern Greece, Macedonia, speaks to him and says, come and help us, come and help us, come and help us. And so he changes his plans. They go into northern Greece. The problem is, it doesn't go so well. They get to this one city called Thessalonica, and there, a kind of a riot erupts. And Jews, who are hardline Jews, who don't like Paul, don't like his message, don't like the Christians, they just get this guy thrown into prison. And they said, these people who turned the world upside down, these troublemakers, they're here in our city. And so Paul and his team, they're bundled out of Thessalonica. They go down south to another place called Berea. Same thing happens. And so basically the Christians, the few Christians that are there, they get Paul, because he's the most recognizable, and they just put him on a boat. They say, like, get him out of here. Stuff is blowing up, and it's dangerous for us. We're being arrested. We're being persecuted. So just put him on a ship. Ship to where? Doesn't matter. First ship. First ship is going exactly the wrong direction. Instead of northern Greece, he's going to southern Greece. He ends up in Athens. So he's waiting around in Athens. He's not going to synagogues there. He's just kind of like doing a tourist type thing. He's in an Airbnb. He's hanging around Athens. He's waiting for the rest of the team to come down. And it's this unusual thing. And it's kind of almost like he wasn't looking for it, wasn't planning for it. But he goes into the marketplace, the Areopagus, which is where they do their philosophical debating. And he sees all these idols and altars for idols. Now, in those days, everyone worshipped idols. And you'd have an altar, and you'd bring your lamb, and you'd sacrifice on the altar to that particular idol. So the goat god, or the snake god, or the kind of goddess of the hunt, or Athena, or whoever it may be. But he noticed that of all the altars with idols on, there was one altar with no idol. And it just had an inscription, and it said, "To the unknown God." To the unknown God. And so people would come in Athens, and they basically had this sense, there's something out there, and we feel like our knowledge of the world is incomplete. We feel like there's something missing. There's something they're not telling us. So we've got all these different gods. We've got the Roman gods. We've got the Greek gods. We've got the pagan gods. We've got the family gods. We've got the kind of the cultic gods. But we feel that it doesn't quite answer the questions that we have. And you might be here as someone, you're not sure about faith. You've got questions, but there's something inside of you that says, I feel like there's more out there, and I don't know what it is. And when Paul is invited to speak by these philosophers, he starts to talk about this altar to the God that they don't know. And basically, Paul says, look, I'll be the squirty cream kid. I'll explain to you what no one else will tell you. I'll fill in the gaps in your knowledge. And this is what it says. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So, you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us." Just read that bit in yellow with me. "He is not far from any one of us." Again, loud. "He is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." So Paul preaches this message, and it's unusual because he doesn't mention Jesus. Now, this is a summary that we get in Acts. It would have been a lot longer on the day. But he doesn't mention Jesus. He doesn't open the scriptures. He just appeals to what people know. He appeals to their poets. He appeals to their worship system. He talks about an idol-less altar to the unknown God that they have put up themselves. And so when we talk like this in church, there is precedent for it, and it's actually a really valuable thing for us to do, to engage with the thoughts and the concerns that people have, even if they don't accept scripture. And so this is why I'm going to give you three things that you don't normally get told. And I'm going to tell you something, and you're going to end this message knowing something that you never heard before. And trust me, number three is going to amaze you. It's going to blow your mind. But let's start with number one. This is the first thing that they don't tell you, and that's this. 40% of scientists believe in God. When I talk to people about being a Christian, a lot of the time people will say to me, "How can you believe in that stuff? It's Harry Potter. It's nonsense. It's just medieval mysticism. Science has just proved God. Scientists don't believe in God. Scientists know there's no such thing as God. Science has done away with the need for God." And what you don't often hear is that 40% of scientists believe in God. In other words, roughly the same number of scientists that don't believe in God, so about 40 to 45% of scientists will say, "I'm an atheist," and about 40 to 45% of scientists will say, "I'm a believer." And the other kind of 10, 20% say, "Oh, I don't know." Just like normal population. You have this idea that 90% of scientists don't believe in God, or 100% of scientists don't believe in God, or 95% of scientists. Actually, 40% of scientists do believe in God. And what's remarkable is that this is pretty much universal across all countries. So in the UK, it's the same. In the US, it's about the same. Places like India and Italy, it's a little bit higher because you've got more religious kind of population there. In Italy, it's over 50%. But it's roughly around the same, no matter where you go. A large proportion of scientists actually say, I do believe in God, even though I have a scientific, rigorous world view. What's really interesting, though, is this figure has actually been the same for about 100 years. The first time a survey was done like this, it was in 1914, and they found the same thing. About 40% of scientists believe in God. Because sometimes you hear the idea that the more we know about science, the less it likely becomes that there is a God. The more scientists explore the world, the universe, and life, the more that they would check out of their faith. But actually, the number of scientists believing in God has stayed pretty much level over the last 100 years. Because actually, a lot of the things that science discovers actually makes scientists themselves become believers. Just want to tell you very briefly, a really quick thing. It's the Big Bang Theory. Put your hands up if you've heard about the Big Bang Theory. Okay, it was invented by this guy. Actually, no, that's just a gag. It wasn't that guy, it was this guy. This is the guy who actually coined the term Big Bang. His name's Fred Hoyle. He's dead now, but when he was alive, he was a pretty big deal. Amazing brain, the size of a planet, and a total atheist. And when, in the 20s, people proposed that the universe had a Big Bang, the scientific community went nuts. And most people resisted it. Because scientists had said, actually, if you believe that the universe had a beginning, then you kind of need to have a beginner. If it started somewhere, you have to have an explanation for what started it. And so for centuries, scientists held a view which they called the steady state universe. In other words, the universe has always existed. And when Christians came along and said, in the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth, science said, no, the universe has always existed. It can't have had a beginning, otherwise, you know, we would be in trouble. We'd have questions to answer that we simply cannot answer. And so when people started to propose Big Bang, guys like Fred Hoyle said, I don't accept it, I don't believe it. But in about 20 years' time, in the 40s, they discovered cosmic microwave background radiation, basically the kind of the relic of the Big Bang. It settled the matter once and for all. And so guys like Fred Hoyle, who had coined the term Big Bang as a kind of derogatory term, oh, it's just a Big Bang, you know, ridiculous, they had to rethink. And not only did they find out that the universe had had a beginning, but it had an explosive beginning. And it was like this incredibly lucky, fluky, explosive beginning. So if the density of the universe 1 second after the Big Bang was greater by one part in 1,000 billion, the whole universe would have collapsed in on itself within 10 years. Smaller, less dense, by the same amount, the whole universe would be just empty. And so it was ridiculous. All these things, there's dozens and dozens of constants that we know in nature, in the universe, that are just exactly right for chemistry to work and for physics to work. And so this explosive Big Bang that came from we don't know where just made exactly the right conditions for life. Fred Hoyle, he said this. He said, nothing has shaken my atheism as much as this discovery. And when they dug into it deeper, he says this. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a superintellect has monkeyed with physics. The facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Now, Sir Fred Hoyle, great man that he is, as far as I'm aware, didn't become a believer, didn't become a Christian, but his atheism was shaken. And actually, a number of scientists, as they've looked at it, they've said, well, do you know what? This does seem to point to a creator. Other scientists will say, well, you know, we just happen to be in the Big Bang that produced the right universe, but maybe there's an infinite number of universes out there, the multiverse, and maybe that explains it. We just happen to be in the right one, the human one. But it still doesn't explain where it all came from, what started it, why the Big Bang, why a Big Bang or a multiple billion, infinite number of Big Bangs. Why? Who started it? And so when people tell you that science has disproved God, they're telling you something false. They're not telling you the truth, or they haven't understood it. And I'm not just saying, well, the Big Bang proves that God is real, Christians win. No, what I'm saying is science and faith aren't antagonistic. They're not enemies. They're not at each other's throats. They are friends. They are complementary. And that's why it's very possible to be a Christian and to be a scientist. Because science can tell us how things happened, but faith and the Christian story of God's love shared in Jesus Christ showed us why things happen. So for those of you that have that thing, well, I can't be a Christian because it's irrational, it's unscientific, you just need to know, actually, that's not true. Science, faith, not in opposition. So here's the second thing. The second thing that they don't tell you is this: the gaps are getting bigger. Now, one of the reasons why someone like Fred Hoyle, a scientist, can discover something as mind-blowing as the Big Bang and still not become a Christian is because there's the kind of thinking that God is the God of the gaps. So God is the thing that we've put into the gap that we don't understand. And one day that gap will be closed. So, for example, back in the olden days, when you saw thunder and lightning, ancient cultures, they would say, we have thunder because Thor and Odin in Valhalla, up in the heavens, they're playing bowls. And when they throw their bowls on the floors of Valhalla, it makes a rumbling sound, and that's what we hear as thunder. So that's the clear explanation. Something happens in the world, you can't explain it, you just put God in there. It's God playing bowls. Then science comes along and says, actually, no, it's an electrical discharge from a cloud down to the earth. It causes a channel in the atmosphere. When that's finished, the air rushes back in, causes a shockwave, a sound wave, and that's what we hear as thunder. So, Thor, you're sacked. We don't need you. Be an Avenger, but we're not going to worship you. So, the God of the gaps. And people always kind of assumed that with science, you would just get more and more and more and more knowledge. And the gap that God fit in, the bit that you couldn't explain, would get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until God squeezed out. You know, has to become an Avenger. You know, there's just no room. You'd make him a cartoon character, but we're not worshiping him because we've explained everything. And maybe people like Fred Hoyle said, well, you know, it looks amazingly like a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and chemistry and biology. But maybe as science progresses, the gap will just get smaller and we'll be able to eliminate God from the equation. But actually, the gaps are getting bigger. This is what you won't hear a lot. You won't hear Richard Dawkins coming onto the Graham Norton show talking about how the number of atheists in the UK is shrinking and how the scientific community are finding that they've got bigger and bigger problems with some of the things that they once thought were ironclad certainty. They won't tell you, for example, that 3 years ago in London, in the Royal Society, 300 of the world's top scientists and evolutionary biologists came together for an emergency conference, and the title of the conference was New Theories of Evolution, or New Models of Evolution. And essentially, this conference was called because as we study and as we look at the fossil record and as we discover more about the physical universe and the biological conditions of life, the more we go into it, the more it feels like, actually, the answers that we have so far, they don't really work. There's a massive, massive problem with them. Now, I'm not going to go into it because it's technical and you'll be bored. But let me just tell you one quick thing. It's like we have discovered, and Darwin knew about this, thought it would be resolved by now, but it's got much, much more of a problem. We've discovered that just like there was a Big Bang in the universe, there's been biological Big Bangs. So around about 542 million years ago on planet Earth, there was no plants, there was no animals. There was just at the bottom of the oceans, these little weird creatures that were kind of not really animal, not really plant, just kind of odd, not really following much kind of pattern of life as we know it today. And they were like that for tens and tens and tens and tens of millions of years. And then suddenly, there's this explosion of life, and it happens in a really small period of time. It's called the Cambrian explosion, if you want the technicalities of it. It's about 10 million years. Suddenly, all these loads and loads of different forms of life, in fact, all the kind of prototypes of life that we have today, from plants to birds, dinosaurs, animals, all those things, they just suddenly, boof, they arrive. And they arrive in a just in a kind of evolutionary, minuscule time frame. And it doesn't have any explanation. It doesn't fit the rules of evolution as we know it. Because suddenly, without any kind of ancestor, without anything, well, it's evolved from that, which evolved from that, which evolved from that. No, they suddenly, bam, there's kind of like a plant. And poof, there's something that's going to become a bird. And there's something that's going to become a dinosaur. And it's just very, very difficult to understand. Now, evolution, don't get me wrong. I'm a subscriber to evolution, fully paid up, got my badge, got my membership. But evolution, as we know it, neo-Darwinism, it doesn't explain this. What it's great as, it's explaining the survival of the fittest. We can see that. We can see adaptation. We can see change over time. That's not in dispute. But it's not so good at explaining the arrival of the fittest. Where did these different types of creature come from? And there's loads of other things that we could talk about with DNA and all these kinds of things, and I'm not going to get into it because, you know, most of us, that's above our pay grade. But what I would say to you is this. Instead of God becoming a smaller and smaller proposition, where you need more and more and more faith to believe this, actually, the more we discover about our world, the more it looks like God makes perfect sense, that God is there. And that's why Paul could say God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from every one of us, any one of us. In him we live and we move. Paul is saying, listen, the experiences that you have, you're in God's world. You're experiencing God's life and art and music and taste and friendships and relationships and comedy and adventure and grace and all these things. It's God's world is a reflection of him. And he's put all these things around us so that we could look for him and search for him. And as we search for him with all the intelligence and the skill that we've got, it feels like the more we look, the more it looks like he is real. But here's number three. Number three will amaze you. Number three, the church is growing miraculously. Now, if you were here 2 weeks ago and you heard about the Roman candles, the expansion of the church in the ancient time in the first century, you could be saying to me, well, Philip, that's 2,000 years ago when people were basically primitive and they didn't know anything. What about today? What about in today's world where we have AirPods and Candy Crush and Botox? What about in this world? Well, actually, today, the church is growing in phenomenal ways, just like it grew in the first century. Do you know, shout it out if you do, do you know which country is the fastest growing church? Where's the church growing the fastest in the world today? Who knows? India, China, Iran. Iran. If you said Iran, you have the right answer. Iran is the fastest. The church is growing. I told you, it would blow your mind. Somebody just, what? Honestly, Iran. Do you know? Okay, here's another one. Try this one. Where is the church, the second fastest growing church in the world? Where is it? No, it's still not China. Afghanistan. Afghanistan, where these are repressive Muslim Islamic states. You know, 40 years ago in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, he came up and he started his revolution. There he is, hi. He came in 40 years ago, 1979, and they pushed out the Shah, and they made Iran an Islamic state. So Islam's not just a religion, it's the law. And they shut down the churches, they destroyed the churches, they threw out the missionaries, they made it illegal to become a Christian if you're a Muslim. Illegal. They made it illegal to put the Bible into Persian or Farsi. They made it illegal to preach or do a service in Persian or Farsi on pain of death. 40 years of repressive strict Islamic law under the Ayatollahs. And when they came into power, Ayatollah Khomeini, there were 500 Christians in the whole of Iran. Today, there are over 1 million Christians in Iran today, which is absolutely nuts. When it is illegal, when you are persecuted, the Iranian church, they have no buildings, no centralized leadership, and actually they are mostly led by women. They're underground cell churches. It's just hubs as far as the eye can see, which is why you should be in a hub, because this is what the church is doing around the world. Now, you were saying China. China is actually another good example, because China, where you had Chairman Mao Tse-tung, he came around in sort of the 50s and the 60s, he started the Cultural Revolution. So when Chairman Mao comes, Cultural Revolution, he said, my job is to eradicate all of religion. A repressive communist state where it is illegal to worship as a Christian. Now, when he comes in the 60s, you've got about 4 million Christians in China. China's a big country, you know, 4 million is just a drop in the bucket. But today, the estimate is that by 2025, you will have 160 million Christians in China, which would make it the largest Christian nation on earth. America is about 158 million, but they're all crazy. Sorry. I take it back. Hannah, Bailey, I'm so sorry. What I mean is that in America, it's kind of a cultural thing to be a Christian. Am I right? Okay. In China, this is a mega, mega choice. My daughter, my eldest daughter, she's studying Chinese right now. And her second year, she was in Beijing for a year. Every Sunday that she wanted to go to church, she had to take her passport with her to go to church, because the church that the government allowed was only accessible for foreign nationals. At Christmas, on Christmas Day, she was in Beijing on the university campus. She went out with a plucky band of Christian believers to carol sing in Beijing on the campus. And she's singing Once in Royal David City. And then the security forces came. And she told us this story. She said, Dad, you'd have been so proud of me. I said, why? What did you do? Did you stand firm? Did you resist in the name of Jesus? He said, no, Dad, I ran. I ran so fast, Dad. You'd be so proud of me. I was setting personal bests. I said, is that because everyone else ran? I don't know, Dad. I didn't wait. I didn't watch. I just ran. I said, yeah, I am so proud of you. And actually, in all truth, I wouldn't want my daughter to be arrested on Christmas Day. Not again, dear Lord. You know, I... But obviously, if you're a student, that's a smart play. But there are certain places where people don't get that choice. One woman from Iran made a secret video, and she's recorded as saying this. We know if they get us, the first thing they will do to us as a woman is rape us. And then they will beat us. And ultimately, they will kill us. This is a decision we have made, that we want to offer our bodies as sacrifices. Because I have this thought when I wake up, that when I leave that door, I might not come back. And Christians are paying the price. More Christians are being imprisoned and killed right now than at any other time in history. And in Iran, more people, more Muslims have come to faith in the last 20 years than in the last 13 centuries put together. 13 centuries of Islam, and you have this mass. It's another big bang. It's another explosion. It's another thing that you don't normally hear. You don't normally hear this stuff in the news. It's not normally trumpeted. It's not normally pointed to. But all over the world, people are discovering. God is speaking to people in dreams and visions. He's doing supernatural miracles and healings. Matt Miles and I, we heard some of this when we went to Jordan. Amazing miracles that are happening. But God is moving. So I want to move us to the end and ask the question, so what? So what? What do we need to do? Actually, there's two things that you need to do. If you are a believer here, first of all, you need to be encouraged. Be encouraged that actually what you subscribe to and what you have found to be true is something that is resonating with millions of people worldwide and something which is not in opposition to science and rationality. And the second thing you need to do is to be part of what God is doing. Be part of what God is doing. Get on board with this. We want Metro to be part of that massive explosion of growth, which is why in January we're doing our 5 p.m. service and a 7 p.m. service. We're multiplying because that's what God's people do. We go, even if it costs us, even if it's uncomfortable, we go and proclaim the good news to others. But what happens if you're not a believer here this evening? Well, I've got two things for you as well. First of all, this. Be encouraged. Be encouraged. The reason that you're here is that you feel that there might be something in it. There's that space in your heart which feels like an empty altar to an unknown God. You need to be encouraged that you're on the right track. This stuff makes sense. But secondly, you need to be part of what God is doing. And in a moment, I just want to invite you and offer you the opportunity to give your lives to Jesus. Because the message that Paul proclaims, and the message that we proclaim, the message that Christians are proclaiming all around the world is that God is real. You know this, you feel this, you've been drawn to that reality all of your life. You live in his world, and he's not far from any one of us. He's come down, entered our world, given his life. He's become a human being in the form of Jesus Christ, God the Son, fully God and yet fully man. He's lived a life that shows us what it's like to be human. He's died on the cross for us, and he's risen again from the dead, beaten death down. And now he invites us to enter into this new life of the Holy Spirit, where he comes into us and fills us and makes us the people we were meant to be. So I'm going to pray a prayer. And then when we've done that, I'd like to pray a general prayer for all of us, because I don't know about you, but for me as a believer, I do want to get on board with what God is doing, but I realize I can't do this on my own. And if we want to ask you to go, to bring your friends, to extend an invitation, to bring people to the bonfire party, bring people to the Christmas carol service and get people involved, you need boldness and you need strength and you need the Holy Spirit. So I want to pray for you as well first, later. But first of all, I'm going to pray for those who you just know, I don't know God. I haven't given him my life. He's not real. Or maybe you prayed a prayer back in the day when you were a kid, and somehow you've lost your way. The wheels have come off, and you think, yeah, I need to get myself. I need to be part of what God is doing. I need to get myself sorted. So I'm going to invite you just to pray with me, but let's bow our heads right now. I'm just going to invite you to pray a prayer of commitment to Christ. It might be the first time or it might be an act of just recommitment to Christ. But it's an A, B, C. A, you admit that you need God, that you've messed up without him. B, you believe that he loves you so much that he came to die for you and rise again. And C, most importantly, you commit your life to him, to follow him as he gives you strength. So I'm going to pray the words. These are the words that I prayed when I first gave my life to Jesus. And the words, like the ones I've prayed with literally thousands of people down the years. And I'll just do it a little bit at a time. You repeat it after me. And then I'm going to pray for you. But you make this prayer your own. This is how the prayer goes. Just repeat this after me. Not out loud, just in your head. Dear God, you know my life. You know the ways I've messed up. You know the mistakes I've made. Right now, I want to give my life to you. I want to stop living for myself. I haven't done so well with my own life so far. I don't understand everything, but I believe you love me. I believe you died for me. I believe you rose again. Come into my life, Lord Jesus. Fill me with your Holy Spirit. Let me be part of what you are doing. I offer you my life, and I offer this prayer in simple faith, in in the name of Jesus. Just while people have got their eyes closed, if you prayed that prayer, I'd love to pray for you. So if you want to be included in my prayer, just put your hand up so I can see you and I'll pray for you. Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Put your hand up nice and high so I can see. Brilliant. Thanks. Okay, you can put your hands down.